KUT and KUTX listeners, the stream you've connected to is going silent on April 20th. You're likely using an old bookmark, app, or link that's been around a long time. Please visit kut.org/streams. That's kut.org/streams for more information. If you're still hearing this message next time you listen, there's a form at the bottom of that page that you can fill in for help. Our websites, apps, and npr.org are updated, so you can tune in there. Thank you for listening and supporting our stations.
This is KUT
Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of October 2018. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A boil water notice for the city of Austin that could be lifted on Sunday.
We're hopeful that Sunday we can get there, and that's what we're targeting.
After a rash of vandalism, members of Austin's Muslim community trying to balance safety with openness.
God knows what is going on in their mind, you know, why they're doing it.
And the major policy differences between the two frontrunners for Austin mayor.
Well, we have to rewrite the land development code.
We were very clear that it was supposed to be a community-driven process.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Good morning, I'm Spencer Cronk, Austin City Manager, and thank you for joining us at such an early hour. As you can imagine, when we're calling a media briefing at 6 a.m., it's going to be important, and it is. As it turns out, the unprecedented rain flooding our lakes and rivers is having impacts beyond the dams and shorelines of Central Texas. Our water system is the most recent infrastructure to struggle to keep up with the impacts. Yesterday, we asked our customers to reduce your use, and today, we are now asking you to not drink from the sink.
That was on Monday, and as you know, we've been living through the first boil water notice in the history of the Austin Water Utility. People were going nuts for bottled water, lining up at stores, places were selling out. This guy I talked to, Victor Garza, had been waiting at the HEB on East 7th for 2 hours.
I should have lived a long time ago, but, you know, I got kids, you know, so I just trying to wait for my babies. For me, I ain't worried, but I could boil the water like they say, but it's cool.
Restaurants closed. Robert Maciel, husband of the owner of Joe's Bakery, said his wife decided to close the restaurant on Tuesday.
Coffee, you need water. Tea, you need water. Ice maker, you need water. Bakery, you need water. Personal hygiene, you need water. It's a loss of revenue, but what can you do?
But like a lot of restaurants, Joe's Bakery did figure it out eventually. They decided to stop serving lunch specials and enchiladas. They only used paper plates and plastic utensils. They stopped serving ice with drinks. And actually, with this boil water notice now in its fifth day on this Friday afternoon, the city of Austin has come up with ways to make it easier for restaurants to operate while still making sure they're keeping things clean. KUT's Trey Schar has that.
If a food service establishment in Austin is serving water or something prepared with water, it has to be from an approved source. In other words, boiled or bottled. But for things like dishwashing and hand washing, Austin Public Health has worked out some alternatives. Dishes can be washed in commercial machines with a rinse temperature of at least 165 degrees or a chemical sanitizer. If employees are washing their hands with tap water, they have to follow up with hand sanitizer and single-use gloves. Don Hastings is the city's assistant director of environmental health services. He says this boil water situation is different from one resulting from a water line break when
we're almost 100% certain there's been pathogen contamination of the water, from water going through the soil into the purified water line. In this case, there haven't been any test results that have definitively shown protozoan contamination of the water.
Another difference is that a water line break can be repaired quickly, with water service restored in a day or two. The boil notice we're dealing with is expected to last at least until Sunday. Trey Schar, KUT News.
So when will this all come to an end? The target is Sunday. But as KUT's Mose Bouchel reports, that depends on how much improvement the city makes in its water quality and water quantity.
Austin's water utility is trying to replenish the supply of treated water in its system while assuring that water meets safety standards. Authorities think Sunday could be the day when both of those variables fall in line and the boil water notice can be lifted.
we're hopeful that someday we can get there, and that's what we're targeting.
Jenny Guerrero is a spokesperson for Austin's water utility. She says before the boil order is lifted, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality will need to do enhanced testing of the city's drinking water. She says even if the order is lifted, the conservation mandate will remain to help the city continue to refill its storage tanks. Mose Bouchel, KET News.
For more about this, let's bring in Professor Lynn Katz. She's the director of the Center for Water and the Environment at the Cockrell School of Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Katz, can you help us understand what's going on at the water treatment plants in Austin?
The thing that I think is most important to understand is that the city is working very hard to affect water treatment of a, you know, of the water that has changed dramatically. So as you look at the rivers or lakes, as you drive past them or walk past them, you'll see that they look very, I think one group referred to them as chocolate milk. That milkiness is coming from all the silt and mud in the water. And that turbidity is what's making it very, it's called turbidity, but that turbidity is what is making it challenging for the drinking water treatment plants to treat the water. The level of turbidity or the level of cloudiness or murkiness of the water is about 100 times greater than it normally is. That creates challenges for the drinking water treatment plant. So what they're likely doing is trying to optimize their process to treat this water that's very different than their normal water that comes in. And what they're trying to ensure is that when the water leaves their treatment plant, it has the quality that meets the standards that are set by the federal government and that ensure the safety of our public health. So as a result, you know, they're going to keep this boil water going until they feel that the water will continue to meet those expectations. As far as I know, they haven't violated any standards, which means that the water that's coming to your house is still within limits, but that they want to make sure that it is safe and they're being cautious because the quality can change as they continue to treat water.
Why is it so important for people to reduce their water consumption right now? Right. How does that help?
Normally, they're going to treat a lot more water, right? So their normal ability to treat water has been reduced. They're providing less water, and they're allowing their processes to basically run longer or to be able to keep their filters cleaner by not running so much water through them. By reducing the amount of water that they provide, they can get the quality to what they need to. And so it's a trade-off between how much water they're putting out and the quality of that water, in essence. The reason they're asking people, and I would urge people to try to conserve water, is because they're trying to provide the quality of the water at a reduced quantity.
I understand part of that has to do with maintaining water pressure for a number of reasons, including firefighting.
Exactly. You need to have the water flows for the fire hydrants, but you also have to maintain the pressure, because if you ever get to the point where you have negative pressure in the pipes, and what can happen is water can infiltrate, and that water would be untreated water that would infiltrate. So they need to maintain the pressure, and they need to maintain the flow.
If there are more storms of this nature as a result of climate change, is there anything that Austin Water might want to look at in the long run to prepare for these types of situations where there's so much turbidity in the water?
You know, as everyone has said, this is relatively unprecedented. We do see turbidities get this high, but not for this extended period of time over this broad an area. My expectation is that as we see waters like this, like we're seeing now, they're getting the experience with understanding how to treat this water effectively. So experience is one of the best things they can get. You know, whether in the future they look at alternative options, I can't say what the best strategy is at this point, but a lot of it is being able to know what the water quality is and to be able to treat it. And so having experienced this, they're going to have learned quite a bit about how their plants can be optimized for waters that are more turbid. You know, what are the best chemical doses? you know, when should they start reducing the amount of water they process, and how best to optimize that would be my expectation.
Professor Lynn Katz is the director of the Center for Water and the Environment at the Cockrell School of Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Katz, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This whole situation in Austin has left a lot of people wondering what is wrong, if anything, with the city's water treatment process. Well, as KDUT's Nadia Hamdan reports, a local group has been asking that question for years, just not about Austin.
Around 7:30 this morning, I stood near the parking lot at Auditorium Shores. A small group of runners were unloading plastic jerry cans onto the sidewalk. Most of these jugs are filled with 5 gallons of water.
When I'm carrying this thing, I don't think about how long it is. I think about get myself to the next intersection and get yourself to the next light, because it's really that difficult.
That's Peter Rauch. He's president and co-founder of the Gazelle Foundation. It's a nonprofit that works to build clean water systems in one of the poorest countries on Earth, Burundi, Africa.
Very timely for us right now here in Austin. What we're dealing with is actually trivial to what people in Burundi deal with on a daily basis. Most people there walk 2 to 4 miles to grab a 5-gallon jug, fill it with dirty water, and carry it home, and that's it for the day.
Rauch was there to simulate that daily journey of many Burundians. He, along with others, will take a 5-gallon jug, hoist it on top of their heads, and walk all the way from Auditorium Shores to the State Capitol building. But Rauch and the rest of the group are also here to commemorate something, or shall I say someone, else.
Yeah, I heard him arrive. I heard the big booming voice.
Gilbert Tuhabunye is another co-founder of the Gazelle Foundation. For him, this walk is personal. He's from Burundi. Not only did he make those long treks for water as a child, he's also a genocide survivor.
25 years ago, I survived one of the worst massacres in Burundi, where I almost lost my life. I spent 8 hours in the burning building. Luckily, I got out, but I lost 30% of my body. It was a third-degree burn.
Tuhabunye says each year, around the anniversary of this horrific event, he does this walk to remind himself of how fortunate he is to be here. He also makes sure to remind everyone else.
Think about the last week where we have to boil water that was just a few feet away from your bed. You don't have to travel miles to get water. You just need to boil water. Think about the people that have walked 2 miles, 3 miles to get dirty water. We are so blessed.
And with that, Tuhabunye puts a small round pillow on his head, lifts the 5-gallon jug on top of it, and starts walking.
Let's do it, guys. Here we go.
Everyone follows his lead. The group heads east on Riverside and then north onto Congress until they reach the steps of the Texas Capitol building. It's only about 1 mile, shorter than the walks made by the people in Burundi.
The average on a daily basis is like 4 miles for,
2 miles, 2 times.
Yeah, the kids going to get a water.
One way.
That's the average.
Although she isn't carrying a water jug, Courtney Waldron is making the walk in solidarity. She's known Tuhabunye for years and recently joined the Gazelle Foundation as its new executive director.
I feel like, I can donate $25 to my kids' school. I'm sure it goes to some good, but $25 would change somebody's life. It's hard to do better than that.
In the 13 years since it started, the foundation has helped provide clean water to around 92,000 people in Burundi. But Rauch says that's not the number he's most proud of.
Where we have worked, we have evidence that one child per month is not dying due to waterborne diseases.
We make our way through the gates of the Texas Capitol grounds. Tuhabunye turns to the group with both his hands outstretched, the jug balancing on his head.
Everybody, yeah, we made it!
Austin's boil water notice has made many of us realize how often we take for granted the clean water we have here. But Tuhabunye says we should never forget our privilege. We should be using it to lift up the ones who really need help.
Back in Burundi when I was growing up, I used to fetch water 2 miles down, 2 miles with this jug, and then 6 miles to school. I don't have to do that anymore, but there's people that still do it. They need your help.
The Gazelle Foundation will be hosting a Run for the Water fundraising event on November 4th. There's more information at gazellefoundation.org. Nadia Hamdan, KUT News.
Yeah!
A civil rights group is warning Texans to double-check their ballots if they vote straight ticket. That's because some voters have been reporting problems with a commonly used voting machine. As KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, that type of voting machine is used right here in Travis County.
James Slattery with the Texas Civil Rights Project says his group has been hearing from voters across the state, calling into an election hotline about issues they're seeing with the Hart eSlate machines.
We've been hearing reports of voters who go to the booths, they try to vote straight ticket, and then the next screen they see, it appears that their vote has been selected for a candidate of the opposing party.
Travis County Clerk Dana Debevoise says she hasn't heard reports of this happening in Austin, but she says it's possible for voters to change their votes if they accidentally touch buttons before letting screens load up. Slattery says thankfully there's a solution to all of this. He says voters should always double check that all their votes were cast the way they intended before hitting the big red button that says cast ballot. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The President of the United States was in Texas this week in Houston as he makes his way campaigning across the country. Houston Public Media's Elizabeth Trovall was there.
President Trump rallied with Texas Republicans Monday evening as part of his national tour ahead of midterm elections. Texas Trump fans nearly filled the 18,000-seat Toyota Center in downtown Houston to catch a glimpse of the man himself. Ray Ahmed drove down from Austin to see the president.
You know, I wanted to see the memes live.
Ahmed says he supports the president's tax cuts as a small business owner. Also in the crowd, Susan Seiler and her friends sport matching blue adorable deplorable sweatshirts.
So we're here supporting Ted Cruz and any of the other Republican candidates.
She says she drove in from Lake Jackson, 60 miles south of Houston, to see the president for the first time. Senator Ted Cruz, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, and Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick all spoke at the event, uniting around Trump tax cuts and border security issues. Later, Senator Cruz introduced the president to his fans, many sporting red Make America Great Again hats. Cruz praised Trump tax cuts in contrast to his opponent, Congressman Beto O'Rourke.
Beto voted against the tax cut. He voted repeatedly in favor of higher property taxes.
Cruz also hammered on O'Rourke for not being tough like him on border security and immigration, a sentiment echoed by the president.
O'Rourke voted in favor of sanctuary cities that result in the deaths of countless Americans.
True to form, President Trump spoke to his base with multiple allegations that immigrants from Central America bring crime to the country.
America is respected again because we are putting America first.
He also referred to himself as a nationalist.
You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay?
Trump also made several attacks on the media, which led to widespread booing and called for more money to finish the wall. The president has three more rallies scheduled this month in Illinois, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall.
A mosque in North Austin is stepping up security after a number of acts of vandalism in recent weeks. A nearby Muslim-owned business was also targeted, and police believe a single suspect is behind these attacks. KUT's Saida Hassan has more about how the Muslim community is responding.
The day I went to meet Imam Islam Mossad at the North Austin Muslim Community Center, you'd never know what happened here just a few weeks earlier.
Hi, assalamu alaikum.
We met in the middle of the afternoon. The mosque was almost empty, except for a couple of men napping on the floor of the prayer hall. We stepped into Imam Mossad's office to talk about what happened here on September 2nd. Around 1:30 in the morning, someone slashed the tires on a vehicle in the parking lot. The mosque's front doors and windows were also shattered.
It was troubling, but we thought this is just a one-time incident, just a random incident, and we can move on.
But less than 2 weeks later, two of the mosque's own vehicles had their tires slashed, and a window on the building was cracked. 4 days after that, the glass front doors of a Muslim-owned grocery store down the street were smashed. Austin police have identified a person of interest from the store's surveillance video. They say it appears to be the same suspect shown on the mosque's surveillance footage.
So this person is very brazen, very deliberate, and targeting the Muslim community.
The mosque recently hired an armed security guard. The Austin Police Department has also increased patrols in the area. The North Austin Muslim Community Center has been around since the 90s. On any given week, about 2,000 people attend Friday prayers here. Imam Mossad says they've dealt with hate speech and vandalism in the past, but never a series of attacks like this. These days, Imam Mossad is trying to balance new safety concerns with the mosque's open-door policy. When your community is being targeted, he says, the tendency is to lay low.
There are large numbers of Muslims who would rather be unnoticed as opposed to rocking the boat, and we want to let the new generation of Muslims that grew up in America, that were born and raised in America, to bring that American outspokenness to our community and to represent the community positively.
In the weeks after the attacks, prayer services have continued as usual. Like a lot of mosques, the North Austin Muslim Community Center offers separate sections for men and women to pray. None of the women at the service wanted to talk to me on tape, but some told me they were shocked to hear about the attacks, that they felt so random. I got the same response from Yisa Suleiman.
God knows what is going on in their mind, you know, why they are doing it. I have no idea why.
Suleiman comes to the mosque almost every day for evening prayers. We spoke outside the entrance to the men's prayer hall. In the foyer behind him, a TV monitor flashed surveillance photos of the vandalism suspect and a request to send tips to Austin police. Suleiman says the whole experience has brought him closer to the congregation.
I feel more stronger to worship God and to come here. I feel safe, you know. You can be going down the street and people, you know, can even attack you down the street. So this is a place of worship, so I feel safe coming here.
Just down North Lamar at the new Medina Market, I met with employee Hussein Sayed. This was the store that was vandalized after the mosque. It was a balmy evening, and a fan mounted to the wall behind Sayed was on high speed. He took a break from ringing up customers to show me around the store. Standing next to cartons of mango juice, Sayed told me what happened here on September 17th.
I immediately checked the video, and we find that some guy was walking in front of our store, and then he break the glasses.
At around 2 a.m., the market's front doors were smashed. 3 days later, it was attacked again. Surveillance footage shows someone breaking the store's windows with a hammer. On the day I met Sayed, there were thick black strips of duct tape patching up the shattered glass. After the second attack, Sayed says they've been hesitant to fix the doors.
We was worried maybe he will come again and break it. And now you can see we have fixed a shutter outside.
He points to a barred metal gate in front of the glass doors.
So now in the night when we go, we lock our door and then we close the shutter. And we have spent a lot of money.
When I asked Sayed how he's dealing with all of this, he laughed. He gave me the type of pragmatic response I've heard from so many South Asian parents.
Yes, we are not worried. We trust our Allah. And we have to do our safety.
APD is investigating these incidents as possible hate crimes. They also held a safety workshop at the mosque along with the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. Myra Sheikh is executive director of the Austin chapter of CARE.
After the fourth incident, we started to realize that, look, irrespective of what the potential motivations may be, bias or otherwise, people are starting to get concerned.
Sheikh hopes trainings like these will make Austin's Muslim community more comfortable talking to the police. A recent CARE report showed a 17% increase in reports of anti-Muslim bias incidents nationwide between 2016 and 2017, and a 15% increase in hate crime reports.
And I think a lot of times, especially in immigrant communities, people are a little bit afraid to approach the police department. So just even having the face-to-face and understanding where they could call or who they could call was a little bit different. I mean, the officers were kind enough to provide their own contact information as well.
About 20 miles west of the North Austin Muslim Community Center, another mosque has opened its doors after a major setback. The Islamic Center of Lake Travis sits along a winding two-lane road.
This hall can hold a decent amount of people. We have a nursery also upstairs for kids to...
Board member Shaquille Rashid shows me around the main prayer hall. There's a chandelier hanging from the ceiling and sunlight streaming in through the windows. When the mosque was still under construction last year, a fire burned the structure to the ground. Authorities haven't determined an official cause yet, but after months of fundraising and rebuilding, the mosque finally opened for services this past May.
If we look at that incident, yes, it was really horrible, but it also brought our community together and it exposed our community to a lot of other communities around here. So I shouldn't call it a blessing, but we basically reacted in the way that we could use whatever happened to a positive end.
The Islamic Center of Lake Travis has also invested in new security systems. Rashid says there's no foolproof way to prevent someone with hateful intentions from harming a mosque, but tightening security is the smart thing to do. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Coming up on the final week of early voting for the November 6th elections in Travis County, early polling places are open through the weekend, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Go to votetravis.com and you can get estimates on wait times at different polling stations so you don't spend more than an hour waiting at one place when you could just breeze in and out at another. If you are voting in the mayor's race in Austin, we want to try and help you make up your mind. So we held a series of candidate forums earlier this month, including one for the mayor's race. The mayor's race was an hour-long forum at Wesley United Methodist Church in East Austin. We're going to play part of that forum now with incumbent mayor Steve Adler and former city council member Laura Morrison. And in case you're wondering, you can watch the entire forum, including a chance to hear from five additional candidates for mayor at KUT.org. But let's go ahead with the two front runners in this race. We'll start with a question about the city's recently scrapped land development code rewrite, Code Next. We asked Adler, what went wrong and what's next?
Well, we have to rewrite the land development code. It's a 30-year document. It's been amended many times. And while it is not the answer to affordability and to transportation and you know, gentrification, we're not going to be able to answer those questions without redoing the code. So it's something that has to get done. We pulled back from the process. We'll carry forward the things that were developed in that process that are good. But it was a process that wasn't going to get us to consensus. You know, I went into too many parts of the city where people would say to me, we need to, here's a picture of gentrification in my neighborhood, here's a picture of flooding in my neighborhood, here's a picture of a family that's moved out of my neighborhood. This is why I don't support Code Next. And I would look at them and I would say, you know, if you have a picture of it, it's not Code Next, it's Code Now. And when I would go into neighborhoods, and half the neighborhoods in the city, there were a significant number of people that would tell me that Code Next wasn't going to be able to move forward or shouldn't because it was the product of greedy developers that were out to just put money in their pockets. But I would go to another set of neighborhoods, and they would tell me it shouldn't happen because it was being pushed by racist NIMBYs in our city. And the truth is that neither of those were true. I think that really the vast majority of people in this city would have been able to reach consensus on a process, which is what Code Next was. And I still think we're going to be able to get there. But we need a process that people are going to be able to trust, where they feel like they were heard. We've gotten a lot of work done. And I believe that the city will be able to pick it up and move it forward. But we have to come up with a process that will get us across the finish line. And the one that we had was not going to get us there.
Laura, you have blamed the undoing of Code Next on, quote, Adler's failed leadership. What do you think went wrong, and how should Austin handle a rewrite of its land development code going forward?
I was on the city council when we kicked off this process to redo the land development code, and we were very clear on some priorities and processes that needed to be followed to be able to really achieve the goals that we had. And unfortunately, those priorities and those processes were abandoned. For instance, in terms of priorities, we worked really hard to get this priority in Imagine Austin and said, when we rewrite the land development code, one of the priorities has to be that families will be able to remain in their homes. And, you know, right out of the block, the first iteration of Code Next was projecting over 100,000 people would be displaced in the next 10 years. The other part of it is the processes. We were very clear that it was supposed to be a community-driven process. We knew that there were going to be controversial issues, and so we put pieces in place that would, like, if, for instance, required that they bring forward alternatives for a public discussion on the controversial issues so that they could be settled before spending $8.5 million and having to scrap it. So in my view, it needs to be community-driven. It needs to really settle on the priorities and ensure that it helps the city grow stronger and not just remake and displace people. And in terms of where we need to go from here, that there has been so much trust that's been broken with City Hall over this process because people weren't heard when they raised their concerns. So I think that we need to break down the targets on where we want to accommodate growth and how much we need to accommodate growth and how we're going to achieve affordable housing in the different districts and really work with the community on how to achieve those targets. Because the folks that are on the ground, the community that is closest to the issue is the one best suited to come up with the solutions.
Last year, the Austin City Council adopted the Austin Strategic Housing Blueprint, which specifically includes affordable housing goals for each council district, including that 10% of rental units in each district be affordable to families of four making less than $26,000 a year. We'll start with the mayor on this question. How would you convince neighborhoods that have little affordable housing to buy into this mandate?
My sense is that in this community at this time, the goodwill and the desire to create mixed income opportunities in all parts of our city is something that is widely held. It's not held that way by everyone in the city, which is why we certainly have some NIMBY interests and folks that want this challenge to be met in areas other than their own. But I'm convinced that as I go around the city, and I've been in hundreds of different neighborhood meetings all over this city, that most of the residents in most of the neighborhoods genuinely want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be able to live in all parts of our city. People recognize that children that are growing up in mixed income opportunities do better. All children, whether they come from an affluent family or in a family that is not sharing. So I think that one of the most important things to do is just to help communities be able to come together, to give them tools that they can really use to listen to how they would place those mixed income opportunities in their areas, but then also to be strong as a community to demonstrate that the community will exist. And I think this community has done that and is moving further in that direction.
And Laura, same question for you. With these goals for affordable housing units in every council district, how would you convince neighborhoods that currently have little affordable housing to buy into this idea?
I've been a longtime advocate of making sure that we have affordable housing in all parts of town. In fact, when I was on the city council, we wanted to make sure that there was really a strong dialogue between affordable housing developers and neighborhoods and the folks that live in all across the town. And so we came up with what's called a good neighbor program with guidelines about, you know, this is really how folks should have an expectation of being able to communicate with each other. I think that the bottom line is you see neighborhoods all different parts of the city crying to the council to please make the affordable housing requirements in certain zoning deals stronger and wanting more affordable housing from the Grove to Plaza Saltillo. And so I think that, as I mentioned before, we need to set our goals for affordable housing in number of units and the different levels in all parts of town and ask the community, it'll be clear that this is the target, tell us how we're going to meet that target. And, you know, there's many, many tools for meeting it. It's not just putting stuff on public land. It's not just bond-sponsored or bond-funded projects, but there are also opportunities for increasing height in some areas that would then allow you to do density bonuses and all of that. So my challenge to the smaller community areas would be to say, here's all the tools. Now, tell us how we're going to incorporate that affordable housing into your area, that number. And I do think that we need to be really careful. I saw some numbers that came out of one analysis in late summer that showed that Code Next, that the lion's share was of affordable housing was going to be in District 1, just like the lion's share of the new units were going to be in District 1. I think we need to have a broader conversation to think about what is the equitable way to distribute our growth across the districts and to distribute our affordable housing across the district, as opposed to just having a flat rate or accepting what came out of an analysis like that.
Austin police officers are currently working without a contract. The council voted in December against accepting the contract on the table. What would you need to see in a new police contract to vote for it? And we're going to start with you, Laura.
Well, I think that there were some hard issues on the table, and my disappointment in the way that all has played out is that we haven't really heard a broad, open, transparent conversation from the council members who are ultimately going to have to approve the contract about what they're looking for in a contract. And it might not be 11 votes for it, but there needs to be some guidance of what policies the city's looking for. We need to, there are questions right now about what goes in a contract, what doesn't go in a contract. Obviously, we need to have strong oversight and an improvement in our oversight process. We need to have assurance that that we have mental health training and appropriate mental health response planned for mental health issue, response calls that are needed, because those are some of the very critical issues on the table in terms of how we need to be improving. I understand that. But also, it's a money issue, and how much, what is the pay scale and the different kinds of stipends and things like that that the council feels that they can pull in. And I have my own views on that. Of course, I want to make sure that our police officers are paid in such a way that they're, they get the respect that they deserve, and we're not going to have churning and turnover. But the bottom line is that we need the leadership that will have that hard conversation in the open. It's not very politically comfortable to do that, but I think that that's the kind of thing that's going to be able to provide the negotiating team on both sides with an answer of where they need to go to be able to get this thing done.
Thank you. And Mayor, same question to you. What two things would you need to see in a new police contract?
There are three things I would like to see in a police contract. The first one is sufficient pay to make sure that we have the cream of the crop in terms of the recruits and the officers. The city of Austin is the safest large city in Texas and one of the five safest largest cities in the country. property crime is at a 20-year low, and one of the significant reasons for that are the officers that we have. And we pay our officers more than any peer city pays the officers. The last study indicated that we paid the officers 10 to 12% more than number two. And while I don't know that we need to pay our officers that much more than number two, I think it's real important that we preserve the competitive advantage that we have as a city in making sure that we pay our officers more than any other peer city. The second thing is we need to have a sufficient number of officers. And we need to have enough officers so that we can do community policing well in this city, so that when an officer goes into a neighborhood, the officer knows the people in the neighborhood. It's not an unfamiliar place or unfamiliar people. And so when a police officer comes into a neighborhood, the community knows that police officer, and that police officer is not an unfamiliar person to the community. We need to make sure we have sufficient detectives, and we're short on those right now. So we need to make sure that we do a contract that lets us have the correct number of officers. And then, real important, we need to make sure that we have the proper oversight provisions. We need to make sure that the community has the ability to insist on the accountability that any police force should be held to. And that means having access to information and processes available, and at the same time protecting the legal and constitutional rights of our law enforcement officers.
This next audience question is something that I think we're all thinking about, especially in the past couple of weeks. How do we grow as a city and protect citizens from flooding? And we'll start with Mayor Adler.
Flooding is a big issue in this community. Central Texas is one of the most flood-prone areas in the world, flash flood-prone areas in the world. And certainly, historically, the city adopted land development policies which enabled people to build and not be accountable for the impervious cover or the runoff that they were creating. And that's something that multiplies over time, and we live with that effect now. But one of the things that I thought was a real strength of the Code Next process that we were in were new development standards. Right now in the city, if you're developing a piece of property, you're responsible for making sure that there's no greater runoff on that property than before you began to develop. But some of the greenfield requirements that were part of the discussions associated with Code Next would say that if you're developing a piece of property, you have to make sure that there's no greater runoff on that property than would have existed if you were developing that property as if it were a greenfield, as if there was nothing on it. And I think that's important for us to be able to do. And policies like that will help us with flooding in the city. We have a lot of ground to make up because historically we weren't adopting those kinds of policies. And we have to be deliberate and definitive with respect to not allowing building in floodplain areas so that we're not creating problems that future councils are going to have to deal with after us.
Laura, the same question to you. How do we grow as a city and protect citizens from flooding?
That is a question that's becoming more and more serious every day. You're probably familiar with Atlas 14, which is a study that's coming out from FEMA showing that, especially in Central Texas, we're expecting a lot more rain, and our floodplains are going to be getting bigger. And so, obviously, our land development code, we need to be working through that to make sure that we're not building in floodplains. But, you know, there was a flood mitigation task force, and one of the important things that they brought out there is that it's a regional issue because there's water coming from upstream and it's going downstream. Our water's affecting downstream. And so it needs to be addressed in a very collaborative way all across the area. But we also need to keep in mind, and we need to, you know, delve into those mitigation recommendations and be more serious about integrating them into how we're moving forward. It's a shame to not take advantage of all the good work that was done there. But we also need to keep in mind that it's a real equity issue because traditionally, unfortunately, the history is that the lower income areas of town have not been protected as well as the other areas of town. And, you know, when I was on the city council, we were able to rectify some of that with the creek protections on the east side of town. It's a critical issue, and we need to realize that as we're looking toward what are going to be the new floodplains, there are going to be many homes that are now going to be in floodplains that are going to be subject to flooding that we hadn't really envisioned then. And we need to deal with that in a very equitable way, make sure that we're putting in the right kind of corrections to protect people in those areas.
So the debate over health care policy is taking place in Congress and, of course, at the state legislature here in town. What can the city do to improve access to health care for Austin residents? And Mayor, we'll start with you.
Well, you know, health care actual delivery is something that's more the responsibility of the county and Central Health. But there are real important things that the city can do, and we have funded navigators and recruiters and others to help facilitate families signing up for health insurance. You know, we live in a state that has the highest level of uninsured children in the country. And Austin has spent money to try to make sure that we match up people in our community with the health insurance issue. We focused on specific health challenges we have in our community, a lot of which are tied to the disparities that we see in our community. You know, for all the things that are happening wonderfully well in this city, and there are a lot of them, we all know those things, not everybody's participating. I think that the fact that we live in a city where the life expectancy of someone living on the east side of town is 10 years lower than someone who's living on the west side of town, a 10-year differential in life expectancy is horrific. And a fair amount of that issue goes to the disparities in access and in transportation. It's having health clinics that are available. Proposition E in November will help create a community and health clinic in Dove Springs. So it's increasing those kinds of opportunities. It's making sure that people can get to and from. I've worked with HEB, and they've now bought a piece of property in Dove Valley so that we have healthy foods and healthy food opportunities in all parts of our city for all people. That's the kind of work that a city needs to be doing.
Laura, the same question to you. What can the city do to improve access to health care?
Certainly the navigators to make sure that people are have access to and know how to sign up for health care. And that's something that we got started when I was on the council. But I think that we have a lot that we can do. You know, I focused a lot on public health when I was on the city council. For example, making sure that we got funding going to be able to do a program on maternal and infant health among African American families, because the disparity and the mortality and the illnesses that the trouble problems that that demographic had is just incredible. We also got funding for the community paramedics program, which was a really creative program that trains the paramedics and gives them the resources to be able to work with, you know, you might call them frequent flyers, folks that they're picking up and taking to the emergency room a lot, when really they just need to be directed to the correct resources to deal with their issues instead of having to go through the emergency system. And so getting the proper health care for those folks. And those are the kinds of things that are right for the people that are serving. And it also saves the city money. Since I've been off council, one of the activities I've been involved in is working with the Ending Community Homelessness, as well as on the board of that, as well as Housing Works and was part of initiating a program to focus specifically on families with children that are homeless. And for the first time, we were able to bring the medical community to the table to help us work on that. And that's really important because that's one of the points of entry for folks to be able to be connected with resources. So I'm excited about that, and it also allows us to tap into additional revenue resources, as well as really promoting working more strongly with a stronger partnership with Dell.
That was Austin mayoral candidate and former city council member Laura Morrison in a forum last week with incumbent Mayor Steve Adler. Reminder, you can watch the whole forum and hear from five additional candidates for mayor at KUT.org. That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of October 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.